Dimela Roberts Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. This special is based on a series of oral history storytelling events produced through my organization, Media Rights. In 2025, the ISM Storytellers Project brought community members and artists together to tell personal stories of courage, grace, and grit. The live events had support from the Portland City Arts and Culture Access Fund and Ronnie S. LaCroute. This episode features Black Femme Storytellers, hosted and curated by actor and director Shireen Jacobs. We'll hear personal stories from Shireen.
I have been a deep admirer of Black women my entire life. I have seen the ways that Black women display strength and courage in everything that they do.
Visual artist Sharita Trent.
I realized my fear of failure had become my foundation for success. Through the healing process of making art, I also realized that not only had my art always been good enough all along, but I had been good enough all along.
And Shani Harris Bagwell, actor and founder of Bagwell Consulting.
I believe that freedom of speech is often used as a weapon in this country, not a real freedom. In truth, it's about the freedom of the press to publish truths about our government and leaders without fear of repercussion.
They share their experiences as artists and community members in Portland, Oregon. What began as a personal storytelling event has quickly become an oral history gathering project that captures memories and experiences from some of Oregon's prominent artists and community members. Each event is curated by a local host who chooses storytellers from within their own communities. Media Rights asked board member Shireen Jacobs to be the host and curator of the Black Femme event of the ISM Storytellers Project. Shireen Jacobs is an actor, deviser, and director who has appeared on stages and films around the Portland area. She is also a board member of the Fuse Theater Ensemble and happens to work in procurement at the Multnomah County Library. This event of the ISM Storytellers Project was held and recorded last summer at the beautifully renovated North Portland Library in July 2025. Every host curator starts off with their own story. Here's Shireen Jacobs.
So it's December 2012. I'm new to Portland, just moved in August. And I had been staying with my partner, living in our car during that time. And this weekend, we move into our new place. It is, of course, the coldest weekend of the year, because why wouldn't it be? The job that I was working at gave me a hotel for the weekend, and I needed to get to Beaverton-Tigard area from Gresham on the bus at night so that I could get into this hotel room, because I had to check out, of course. So I sat in the car with my two dogs, taking as much possible time as I could before that last bus hit. I look at my watch. It's time for me to go. I get out of the car, locked all the doors except for the driver's door, because my partner would need to be in the car when they got off of work. Parked at the bank parking lot. I get out of the car, and the door locks. The keys are in the car. The dogs are in the car. The doors are locked. I have to figure out, what am I going to do? Because my partner has no place to go if the doors are locked. But I also have a time limit, because it is going to be the last bus out that will get me from 180th and Sandy out to Tigard. So I walk around the car 2-3 times trying to figure out, how am I going to get into this car? So I think, okay, well, what if I break the window? That would defeat the purpose. Can't break the window. Also, not strong enough for that. All right, well, what if I pick a lock? Well, I don't have those skills. Turns out I can't pick locks. Okay, so that's not going to be useful at all. I should probably learn how to do that. The dogs are looking at me. They're following me around the car, looking at me. And I try to move them, gesture them over so that maybe they can step on the lock and unlock the door. No, I should probably learn how to train my dogs better too. But they did not do that. But they were excited that I was still there, but did not step on the locks. So I'm walking around the car trying to figure out, what am I going to do? I've got a time limit. I got to figure out what to do. I get to the rear passenger side, and it's a minivan. And there's that glass, that vent glass that pops out. Well, I had been in a car accident, and when they repaired the car, they didn't put the latch back on that window. So it was tied with a cloth. So I was like, okay, well, this seems to be the only option, so let's see what we can do. So I reach in, take my hand, unknot the fabric that's holding it, and now I have a space of about 8 inches where the glass opens up. And I look in, and I look again, and I think, well, what other choice do you have? So I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to try to climb in this window. So I go to lift my leg up, but I have no arm strength and I can't do that. So that's not going to work. I thought if I got my lower half in, it's smaller than my upper half. So that would be safer, but no, that I could not do that. So I was like, all right, head first we go. So I slide my head in, move my shoulders, turn around, and I'm looking in the window and the dogs are coming at me like, hey, how's it going? And I'm listening to the glass pressing up against the hinge because I don't want to break it. I think, all right, here we go. And I take my hands and I push myself up, levered over the edge of the window rim, and I start wiggling slowly but surely, trying to get into the car. I try not to think about what happens if I get stuck. I try not to think what happens if someone comes, if the security comes out and asks me, what are you doing here? As I slowly move in, the dogs come over to me. They do not step on the lock, never happens. And I slowly maneuver my way in, feeling the rim of the windowsill pressing against my abdomen, my chest, as I slowly, inch by inch, try to slide my way into the car. I blank out. My mind goes blank. I don't think about the time. I don't think about the circumstances. All I think about is slowly wedging my way into this window and not straining the glass so much that it pops off the hinge. Eventually, somehow, it loosens and I slide directly into the back of the car on my face, because of course I did. I am head first. The dogs come over. They sniff me. They're very proud of me. I'm very proud of me too. I sit there for a moment and marvel at the fact that I actually managed to do this. Then I climb over the front seat. Remember, I still have a time limit. Climb over the front seat. Try this again. Unlock the driver's side door. Step out of the car. Close the door. Nothing. It didn't lock this time. I breathe a sigh of relief. I go catch the bus. I managed to get to the hotel on time. And we moved into our apartment that weekend. And so, as far as courage, grit, and grace goes, I will say this. Sometimes it doesn't look like it, but if you try and put yourself in there, you might just fit.
That personal story came from host curator Shireen Jacobs. Shireen's first curated storyteller in this Black Femme special is Sherita Trent. Sherita is a mixed media and digital artist. She creates what she calls retro illustrations of colorful folks living extraordinarily ordinary lives. You can view Sherita Trent's work at her website of quirkywonder.square.site. Sherita wanted to talk about the healing power of becoming an artist for her story about courage, grace, and grit.
I just got back a few hours ago from visiting my family in Virginia for my grandmother's 100th birthday party. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. While I was there, I looked through my family photos from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and it reminded me of all of the reasons that I make art. I grew up in the late 80s and early 90s in a 70s house on a street called Happy Hill Road. Isn't that the cutest name for a road? What I remember and love the most about the house was the yellow, brown, and orange vintage swirls that lined the living room wall. That and all of the joyful memories I made with my family there, including exercising to Jody Watley aerobics videos on VHS with my mom. Learning to roller skate with my sister in the avocado green kitchen, and spotting hot air balloon sightings with my dad. The energy of these memories would later go on to inform the current digital illustrations that I create of people of color enjoying the magic of the moment while living extraordinarily ordinary lives. I first started drawing for other people when I was in fourth grade. I would draw floral arrangements for my classmates. They'd gather around me and watch my process. And they'd pay me for my pieces with quarters and compliments. And I felt like a tiny celebrity. In high school, I avidly collected Cosmo magazines and referenced the photographs of models to teach myself how to draw black and white pencil portraits floating on top of blank white unfinished backgrounds. In college, I experimented with drawing colored pencil portraits and using foam board to give them 3D depth. I struggled with creating a completed vision and started cutting out pieces from my work because I was afraid I would make a mistake and ruin a piece. But with cutouts, I could preserve the parts of the piece that I liked and make changes. At that time, a big part of me believed that my work would never be good enough. Because of that belief, after I graduated, I stopped making art for a long time. Until one day I went to a friend's house. She had an incredible amount of boxes of patterned papers and said I could take whatever I wanted. Shortly after that, I went to another friend's house and saw that she was in the middle of working on a piece with a wood panel. And then something just clicked within me, and I knew I finally had the recipe that I'd been longing for. I collected my ingredients. Colored pencils, foam board, patterned paper, and wood panels. From there, I started making nostalgic 3D portraits of pop culture icons inspired by my favorite movies and shows growing up, like Coming to America, Ghost, Forrest Gump, Golden Girls. As I incorporated my old cutouts that I had once thought to be incomplete pieces into my work, I realized my fear of failure had become my foundation for success. Through the healing process of making art, I also realized that not only had my art always been good enough all along, but I had been good enough all along, even before I had the tools to complete my vision. And also, those moments of just practicing were part of that whole process as well. In 2020, during lockdown, I decided to post 4 different 3D Golden Girls portraits for sale on social media, and they sold right away. From there, I've continued to expand my products, printing them on stickers, notebooks, tote bags, and more. My online business did well through 2021, but then sales started to significantly slow. I was discouraged, but continued to make art. About a year and a half ago, I was considering making a career change and went to a psychic. She said, "I know that it may be really hard for you because you're an introvert, but this is the year that your guides and ancestors want you to shift to selling your art in person." Up until that point, I never considered bringing my art to in-person events because I didn't have a car, and I'd always thought I'd need to bring my own table. And who wants to do all that, especially in an Uber? A couple days later, I saw a call for artists for a community art show at Alberta Street Gallery. I applied. During opening night, one of my pieces sold within the first half hour. One of the members approached me that night and said the gallery members had been talking about my work and they were looking for a new artist and invited me to apply to be a member. I applied and was one of the 5 finalists. They ultimately decided to go with another artist, but invited me to be a guest artist at an upcoming show, which was so exciting. I've had to work really hard for most of the things in my life, but after that, I was amazed by the amount of ease that would mark the next chapter of my artistic journey. Each in-person event I'd participate in led to another opportunity. I met one customer at my very first pop-up at the Hawthorne Theater over a year ago. She saw one of my pieces of a woman on roller skates in a roller rink with pink and green background and said it looked like an exact replica of a photo of her mother that was taken in the 70s. A few months ago, while I was tabling at a Pride market, that same customer recognized me. I told her that she was one of my first customers at my first pop-up, and I'd always wished I'd given her that print that she said reminded her of her mother. I told her I wanted her to have it for free. She thanked me and said, "I'm gonna go cry now." And I said, "Me too." In April, I signed a 1-year lease at a local female maker collective in Selwood called Plural Collective. It's been really exciting to have my own retail space within the boutique. I think it's gonna go well, but if it doesn't, I don't have to worry because failure is part of my success And by facing the fear of failure, I bring joy to myself and my community. Thank you.
That personal story came from visual artist Sherita Trent. I'm Demela Roberts. You're listening to a special edition of Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. We're featuring stories performed live for the ISM Storytellers Project at the North Portland Library in July 2025. Our next storyteller is Shawnee Harris Bagwell. She's a Portland actress and is also the founder and principal of Bagwell Consulting. Shawnee is a strategist, organizer, and systems thinker with over 25 years of experience in education, public policy, and organizational leadership. For Shawnee Harris Bagwell, it takes courage, grace, and grit to live in Portland, Oregon, every day.
I'm here to talk about what it means to be brave. I believe firmly that you can't be brave unless you're scared. Being brave means being scared and doing it anyway. Every moment of fear is an opportunity to be brave. I once posted a question on Facebook along the lines of, what's a memory you have of me? And my grammar middle school friend Josephine responded that when we were in middle school, we'd been on a trip to Raging Waters. Now, Raging Waters was my favorite place to be during the summer. Water slides, lazy rivers, and teenagers in swimsuits. It's a middle school heaven. She said, we were walking and some grown man catcalled us and she felt self-conscious and scared. She said that I whipped around and screamed at the top of my lungs, we're 12 years old, you pervert. And she felt really proud to be my friend. I don't remember that, but I believe I did it because I do things like that. Even if I feel scared or self-conscious, I have a hard time being quiet when wrong is happening and believe that publicly shaming people is a highly effective tool for correcting bad behavior, or at the very least, to leave you alone. I believe that freedom of speech is often used as a weapon in this country, not a real freedom. In truth, it's about the freedom of the press to publish truths about our government and leaders without fear of repercussion, and the freedom to speak out against our leaders. But most people use it to sexually harass children, or generally be pricks and hide behind freedom of speech as if it includes freedom from consequences. But I believe there are consequences to running your mouth recklessly in public. Often, I am the consequences of running your mouth recklessly in public. I moved to Portland in 2016. When I'm in a new place, I like to observe and learn about the culture of the city I'm in. I grew up in San Francisco, which is a deeply anti-fascist city. If you were seen on the streets or at a bar or a club with racist tattoos, you were likely to get a pretty good beating. You can imagine my surprise when the first time I rode a bus here, a woman got on wearing a sleeveless shirt with swastika tattoos on both of her shoulders, and I grabbed the child I was with in anticipation of an altercation and looked around, and everyone on the bus seemed to think it was a perfectly normal event. I was shook. No one said anything or even batted an eyelash and seemed completely unbothered that we were on a bus with an actual Nazi. I don't want to be that transplant. But in San Francisco, if the bus driver even let a Nazi on the bus, the people on the bus would have a lot to say, and likely the Nazi would not be safe on that bus. In Portland, Nazis were just politely tolerated. No one said anything. Another night on the bus, a man was harassing a young girl. He'd boxed her in her seat. Again, everyone was just passively allowing it. I spoke up and I told him that if he was desperate to talk to someone, that he could talk to me because she was clearly not interested in his conversation and she didn't owe him her time. He looked at her and said something else. And so I asked him again, why won't you talk to me? I thought you wanted a conversation. Let's conversate. Then I asked the young girl to come sit next to me and that he needed to get off the bus. And he did. I asked the girl if she wanted me to get off the bus with her, but she said she was all right and got off a few stops later. Before I got off, a woman approached me and said she had a daughter and felt guilty that she said nothing, but she was scared. I told her that being brave means being scared and doing it anyway. Not a few weeks later, I was on the bus again. There was an Indian family on the bus, and the mother was sitting with the younger child next to her, and there was an older boy standing and holding the pole when he just suddenly passed out. He just dropped. He collapsed, and his mother was frantic. She didn't speak English, but the boy was clearly unconscious and unresponsive, and the mother was clearly panicking and screaming for help. And again, no one did anything. Nothing. No one rushed to her aid. No one pulled out a phone to call 911. The bus driver didn't even stop the bus. No one said or did anything. So I spoke up. I told the bus driver to pull over, screamed for someone on the bus to call 911 and help the mother carry her child, who was taller than she was, off the bus. Again, no one on a full bus said or did anything, not a single person. The bus driver didn't even think to pull over. But folks here don't always stay quiet. If palm-colored people hear a Black woman have an opinion, they suddenly find a lot of boldness. I cannot count the number of times a white person has had a meltdown when I point out racism. I have been screamed at, cried at, trauma dumped on, and one time actually held by my wrists while a white woman begged me to spend my free time at a bar explaining racism to her. Eventually, the freedom colonizers felt saying absolutely wild, rude, and often racist things with the absolute surety that their freedom of speech is protected started to feel normal. But even in the normalization of this behavior, it still couldn't stop being me. Again, I was sitting at the bus stop, waiting, like every day. A houseless person approached me and the modestly dressed gentleman sitting next to me and asked for a dollar. We both acknowledged the person, looked them in the eye, and explained that neither of us carried any cash. The answer seemed to satisfy the person, and they moved away from us as we all continued to wait in silence for the train. The train finally arrived, and we three boarded. I chose an empty seat next to a stranger. The gentleman I was waiting with sat across the aisle from me, and the houseless person proceeded to walk up and down the aisle and ask folks for a dollar. This time, again, no one said anything, choosing mostly to ignore the man, turning away, or refusing to even utter a sorry, I don't have it. Clearly frustrated and feeling invisible, the person walks to the front of the train car and screamed a painful, "Does anyone have a dollar?" That was clearly meant as someone, pay attention to me. Then this unmelanated man sitting in front of me in the window seat yells loudly at the unhoused man, "You are what's wrong with this city," and then sits back smugly. And again, no one says anything. I'd had enough. I yelled, "No, you and your lack of compassion, your lack of empathy are exactly what is wrong with this city and this country. Cold, heartless people like you are exactly what is wrong with America." And he had the nerve to come back with me with, "Can you guess it? Can you guess it? You don't need to yell at me. I'm just using my freedom of speech." That day, I decided to be the consequences of his actions. So your freedom of speech means you can yell at houseless folks, but I can't yell at you? I am also an American. Or did you think freedom of speech applied only to white men? This is harassment. You think that you can say anything to anyone, but freedom of speech is not freedom from consequences. You wouldn't act hurt when your problems are created by you. Then he threatened to call the police on me because I was cussing at him. That's when I really lost it. I told him to call the police. What was he going to say? I'm just exercising my freedom of speech. I can say whatever I want to say, however I want to say it. And I told him that he could have ended this conversation a while ago. All he had to do was shut his trash hole and put his nose to the window. He again tried to act scared and threatened to call the police. And again, I restated, shut your trash hole, put your nose to the window, and mind your business. And he did. You could have heard a pin drop. But this time, someone said something. The gentleman I got on the bus with touched my shoulder and said, "Miss, I am so sorry you had to go through that. I'm a pastor at a church, and we would love to have someone with your radical empathy in our congregation." I'll never forget that phrase, radical empathy. I could see the ears turning red on the powdered donut, who did indeed keep his face pressed to the window, but let on an audible. I smiled and thanked the preacher and told him that I appreciated the invitation, but I was an atheist, and I just hate when people are mean to other people. He thanked me again for speaking up. People always thank me for speaking up. In San Francisco, I was taking the bus alone since I was 10 years old and never had to speak up. I got on the bus, read my book, minded my business. But here I've had to speak up a lot. But I wish more people would speak up. I'm scared too. You can't be brave unless you're scared. But every moment of fear is an opportunity to be brave. Please be brave. Thank you.
We just heard Shawnee Harris Bagwell. I'm DeMelo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. We've been listening to stories performed live for the ISM Storytellers Project, recorded and filmed at the North Portland Library in July 2025. If you'd like to see a film of the event, visit Meteorite's YouTube channel. More stories to come on the Stage and Studio special series. This program is made possible in part by the Oregon Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, the America 250 Oregon Commission, and it's a co-production of Meteorites and Oregon Arts Watch. Find these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org. The Stage and Studio theme is by Clark Salisbury. We featured music by composer Joe Kai. Hear his music at joekai.org. Thank you. This is Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. I'm DeMelo Roberts, presenting some personal stories from events I recorded for the ISM Storytellers Project, produced by Meteorites, my organization. This episode focuses on Black femme storytellers, hosted and curated by Shireen Jacobs.
I am always humbled and in awe of Black women. And in curating this group of people, I chose people that I admire. People that make me want to live up to the best possible version of myself.
And we'll hear stories from Leslie Gregory, physician assistant and founder of Right to Health.
Black people are dying at 3 times the rate of white people. The inequities of employment, education, housing, every sector of our country is costing this country $2.4 billion a year, and nobody wants to recognize it.
And veteran activist and poet Kathleen Sadat.
I grew up in several families. My dad was married 3 times. So I had these really wonderful families to support me. They were passionate. They were loyal. They had tenacity. They were compassionate. They were empathetic. They were kind. They sang together. I was not aware of learning from them at the time, but when I've looked back at it, I understand those words in the context of my life and my family.
Through my organization, Meteorites, we presented storytelling events which brought artists and community people together in small groups to share stories. But it's also evolved into an oral history gathering project. This episode of the ISM Storytellers Project was recorded and filmed in July 2025 at the North Portland Library. Host curator Shireen Jacobs is an actor, director, and advisor who is also a board member of Meteorites and the Fuse Theater Ensemble. Shireen was also an actor in the first production of The ISM Project, an original play with personal monologues that toured around Oregon in 2018 and 2019. Here's how Shireen chose the storytellers for the theme of courage, grace, and grit.
Having been part of the first ISM Project, I was honored to see firsthand how storytelling can connect us, how an individual personal story that may not relate specifically to one person's life does have resonance in all our lives. That this space became a Black woman's space should not have been surprising to me, but that was not originally what I set out to do. But in retrospect, it makes sense that it would be Black women. I have been a deep admirer of Black women my entire life. I had a Black mother, and she was the eldest of 9, almost all of whom were women, and her mother raised her as a single mother as well. So I have seen the ways that Black women display strength and courage in everything that they do. We unfortunately live in a country, I'll just stick to where I live, that isn't necessarily a fan of women and doesn't really like Black folks either. So to be at the intersection of both takes immense amounts of strength just to get up and face the day. And so I am always humbled and in awe of Black women. And in curating this group of people, I chose people that I admire, people that make me want to live up to the best possible version of myself. Today, we have all amazing women in their own right who display courage, strength, grit, and grace in the way they move through the world and in everything they do. And I'm excited that you're going to get to hear their stories today.
That was host curator Shireen Jacobs. In 2026, the Kaiser Family Foundation filed this report. It was titled, Recent Research on How Experiencing Racial Discrimination Impacts Health. The report found that exposure to racial discrimination also is associated with higher rates of preterm births and low birth weight among infants born to Black women compared to white women. It also found that experiencing racial discrimination was associated with higher risk of mortality among Black adults ages 50 and over. Certified physician assistant Leslie Gregory created Right to Health, a Portland nonprofit to address the impact of racism on health. Leslie is a Navy veteran and mother of 2. A longtime Portlander and social justice activist, she focused on healing those affected by everyday racism. For her story on the theme of courage, grace, and grit, Leslie Gregory tells us the long journey she took to get the Oregon Health Authority to address the connection of racism and the health crisis.
So it's been 10 years since I wrote a letter to the CDC and asked them to recognize racism as a public health crisis. The response I got was, to some people, dismissive, to others, gaslighting, to others, placating. But the head of CDC at the time didn't even respond. He passed it over to the Office of Minority Health and Health Equity, and that individual did the gaslighting. A Black woman, PhD, MD, MPH. So a couple of months later, as irritated as I was, I reached out to the head of the Multnomah County Health Department and asked her to recognize racism as a public health crisis. And her response was, it's political. I think that will be very significant at the end of this story. So I reached out to one of the county commissioners who happens to be an MD and said, we need to recognize racism as a public health crisis. And I was told it's political. I disagree, but I'm trying to do my best. She said, you need a resolution. So I went to the Oregon Health Authority and I went to the Oregon Senate, and no one had the courage to listen to me. I was again gaslit and attempted to be distracted. It didn't work. I started a petition online with moveon.org, and you can look it up, asking CDC to recognize racism as a public health crisis. 2 years later, and during the pandemic, I was approached by the diversity and equity coordinator at Oregon Health Authority to lead a task force on health equity. So during the pandemic, you can imagine, this is a joy. I'm running around swabbing noses and in masks and PPE in and out of the clinic, up and down in the parking lot, swabbing noses everywhere. And on my breaks, I'm in these meetings with this health equity task force to try and get Oregon Health Authority's attention on racism as a public health crisis. Black people are dying at 3 times the rate of white people. The inequities of employment, education, housing, every sector of our country is costing this country $2.4 billion a year, and nobody wants to recognize it. This is not political. There are 4 criteria that exist to recognize a public health crisis. This is not political. This is a clinical matter. Fast forward 3 years, House Bill 4052 passes in Oregon recognizing racism as a public health crisis. Raise your hand if you've heard about that bill. 2, 3. All right. Thank you, ladies. The point is, what happened? So I called Oregon Public Broadcasting. The individual I spoke to has interviewed me several times about this issue. Did you hear about the House bill? Well, no, but give me a call when something happens. Really? So I think it's important to realize that these are not just matters of economic impact, although that's one of the criteria. First criteria, is it an impact? Health, life, budget, that's the first criterion for a public health crisis. Okay? The second criterion is it disproportionately impacting a segment of the population? I think we can all agree, criterion's met. The third is it an institutional issue? In other words, could upstream change make a difference? I think we're pretty clear. Institutional racism is a thing, okay? And the fourth criterion is, are current measures insufficient? Anyone? Yeah. If a clinician calls the CDC, which is their job, we're seeing something here in our area that's a problem. What are you going to do about it? And the response is piss poor, gaslighting, dismissive. Okay. So moving forward, and this is kind of why this whole thing came about, the House bill that we got passed, we asked for $8 million. I think that's very little for a state to address a legacy of problems, including no purchasing home laws, not reversed until the 40s. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So we got $4 million. They rolled out in certain grants. We talked about the importance of a mobile unit because I think that's a huge part of what needs to happen. We need to stop asking people to come to care. We need to go get people and provide them care. The money went to a Latino population, the Central City Concern, and the Native tribes. Not one focusing on racism. Not one. Why? Because it's so much easier to talk about health disparities as if there is something innately deficient in the population, rather than to speak about the underlying issue, which is racism. And I have consulted with people all around this country, Association of Black Cardiologists, Jane Elliott, a brilliant educator, David R. Williams from the Harvard Med School. He's spoken here. Innumerable others. Kamara Jones, who's also spoken here about racism. Look her up. She's got a great YouTube on a gardener's tale about racism. It's brilliant. Look it up. All over this country, I've spoken to people about how this shows up in Black bodies, in our budget, in our international reputation, as we go abroad and tell people about their civil rights violations. But just lately, the two previous CDC directors, Rochelle Walensky, on her way out, and this is very critical, as she was leaving the head of CDC, she recognized racism as a serious public health issue. What does that tell you? On her way out. Why is this political? Because racism is political. It's not inherent. It's not appropriate. But it is a persistent misperception that has built this country. Right now, your CDC has been gutted by this administration. And on the way out, Dr. Jernigan left and said, public health should not be political. And this is exactly what's happening right now with your administration. He and four other doctors who are experts in communicable disease have left in protest of what happened to the CDC director. We are about to face another wave of a pandemic that cost this country millions of lives during the previous administration of the orange blight that sits at the helm of our country. And he is undermining public health, has appointed an attorney as head of DHHS and a VAC denier as we are preparing for another season. What I am asking of every single American is to show up with the courage, the grit, and the grace, not only for others, but for ourselves. It's time to reach out to your CDC, your senators, your congresspeople, your representatives, including Maxine Dexter, bless her heart. Call Oregon Health Authority, which has right now a governing board to talk about universal health care in Oregon, which we have no excuse not to have here, and is one of the first steps to address institutional racism in health. Call the governance board right now and tell them you demand universal health care in Oregon. Show up with courage, grit, and grace. Thank you.
We just heard a story from Leslie Gregory, founder of Right to Health. Thank you. I'm Demila Roberts, and next up in the ISM Storytellers Project featuring Black femme storytellers is Kathleen Sadat, who was also in our Queer Elders episode. Her story was so passionate, we asked her to tell it once more. Kathleen Sadat is a public speaker and poet originally from Missouri. She moved to Portland in 1970 and finished her interrupted pursuit of a college degree. She then became involved in civil rights struggles for Black people, women, and the LGBTQ plus community. Sadat organized the first Pride March in Portland. Here's Kathleen Sadat's story about courage, grace, and grit.
I was a little kid, maybe 7 years old, hanging out with my dad. And we're just talking and, you know, being father and daughter. I'm his firstborn and probably the one who was least afraid of him. I had three younger brothers who could hardly talk to him. And he says to me, Kat, would you please go upstairs and get me a handkerchief out of my top dresser drawer? I was immediately terrified. Goblins, ghosts, witches all lived upstairs in the dark where he was asking me to go. And there were no lights on, and I could not get to the light before I had to go through a lot of dark. I would be alone with the monsters. I knew they lived up there. I was terrified. And I said, Dad, it's dark up there. And he said, yes. He didn't say anything else. He didn't say, you know, don't be scared. He just said, yes, matter-of-factly. I decided to try to overcome my fear of the demons because I love my dad. In some ways, I thought of him as Mr. God. And so I went upstairs as fast as I could, grabbed a clean handkerchief out, and dashed back downstairs. What I learned that day is I could do things even if I was terrified. And I think he intentionally gave me that lesson. It was because of how he said yes that I knew it was intentional later when I could think about it. I grew up in several families. My dad was married three times. So I had these really wonderful families to support me. They were passionate. They were loyal. They had tenacity. They were compassionate. They were empathetic. They were kind. They sang together. We rode in the car from St. Louis to Chicago, and everybody sang, and everybody could sing their favorite song or, you know, say, let's do this one next. I was not aware of learning from them at the time. But when I've looked back at it, I understand those words in the context of my life and my family. Now, life was not always easy, but I'm talking to you about those things that gave structure to me and continue to influence the way I am in the world. They worked hard. They supported each other. They helped other people. They were forgiving. They were kind. They spoke up when they heard something was wrong or when they saw something that was wrong. My Aunt Anna, who lived to be almost 100, many, many years ago, I went to St. Louis, back to St. Louis, and we went shopping together. And we went to Lane Bryant because she was going to buy me something. And the woman said, do you have a Lane Bryant card? And my Aunt Anna quickly turned around. She was like 80 years old. She said, no, I don't, because back in whatever year it was, you insisted that my husband be the person who authorized the card. And so I didn't get a card from you. And I went, whoa. She was that kind of person back when people automatically changed their names. Her name was Anna Gunnell. When she got married, her name was Anna Gunnell Wigley. And on the other checkbook, it said Anna Gunnell. They were forgiving of family and friends. They were a bedrock for me. Fast forward, I'm 50 years old. I'm on an airplane flying from Portland to Denver, Colorado. And from there, we're going up to Leadville, Colorado. I'm a member of the American Leadership Forum, and this is the last outdoor adventure that we're doing outside of Oregon. I'm excited. I've been training for this. I have been walking uphill on 33rd Street, that hill that goes up to Fremont, I guess it is. I walked it backwards to get extra strength. Oh, I also climbed Larch Mountain, which is kind of scary. But when we landed in Denver, Vans picked us up, drove us to Leadville. I stepped out of the car and went, I can't breathe. So it's about 9,000 feet up. and I was not prepared for the altitude. And I was very angry because I trained so hard and now I couldn't breathe. I did what they said and I drank a lot of water and I went to sleep. And I woke up the next morning and they said, "We're going in vans now. We're going to climb a rock." I'm afraid of high places. It had never in my entire 50 years occurred to me that anybody would want to climb a rock. I was stunned into silence. I was terrified of heights. We got to the site and they gave us a lecture on tying in and putting these ropes on ourselves. And I listened and they talked about climbing the rock and what you had to do and how you had to do it. I didn't say anything. I just started to cry. I looked at this rock, which is about 80 feet high, and I'm crying. I put on my helmet. They came over and said, "Listen, we want to put an extra rope on you," because I weighed about 230, 40 pounds in. And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, there's a chance you might slip. And if you do, you might turn upside down. And so we want to have this extra rope to be able to put it on." So I'm crying. I said, "Yes, I have this on." I go over and I sit at the foot of the rock on another rock. And I'm just crying. I'm just weeping because I'm terrified. And then I started to talk to myself. This is why you came. You came here to do a hard thing. This is the hard thing you came to do. This is your reason for being here. Now, most of my class had already ascended the rock. Some had even rappelled down. I'm still crying. I haven't stopped crying. I go over and I start to climb the rock. I found ledges and crevices that got me up the rock until maybe 2/3 of the way, and I froze. I lost faith in myself. I lost faith in the ropes. I lost faith in the rock. I couldn't move. Well, now I'm really boohooing. And I'm screaming, "I must be having a low blood sugar." My friend Paul, who was my classmate, a confident climber with little short stubby legs, climbed up the rock, brought me some sugar tabs. And he said, "Okay, can you move now? Can you put your foot over there?" "No, it's too far away." "Can you put your foot right?" "No, it's too small. It won't hold me." "Can you do?" "No, I can't do it." And he just took my foot and put it on a ledge. And in doing that, the spell was broken and I started to climb. Now, remember, I have not stopped crying all this time. I am still crying, tears and everything running down my face. I thought it wouldn't hold me. I thought I couldn't do it. And then this person came and moved my foot, which moved my whole spirit, my body, my confidence, and I went on up. I got to the top. The two women who were sitting belay for me, that's so that you, if you fall, they catch you. You know, they hold the ropes. They're crying. A couple of other classmates are standing there crying. Now, all the way up the rock, there's a group of people down below who've already climbed, and they're going, "You can do it. You can do it. You keep on, keep on." And I was aware of feeling at some point like those voices were pushing me up the rock. They were just giving me the strength to go to the top. The women who were sitting there, one of them said, "It looked like a baby being born when your head came over the top." I was exuberant. I was exhausted. Somebody asked me if I wanted to rappel. I said, "I didn't think so." It was a wonderful experience to be in that place and not have anyone say, "Hurry up," or "She's taking too long," or "Don't be afraid." They just kept saying, "You can do this. You can do it. Keep on. Keep on." It took me longer than anyone else in the class to climb that rock. It was cold and damp. Nobody complained. At one point, when I was standing there, I could see the rain clouds coming in. I said to myself, "Get your ass up this rock." I still feel uplifted by that whole thing. Just, you know, it never stopped. I want to tell this story today because courage right now, in this time, in this place, courage is what we need. And courage is doing that thing even when we are afraid. And I want you to think about, please, we need courage to trust, means being vulnerable, having faith. To have faith, maybe, more than trust, because trust usually has a little evidence behind it. Faith has your belief. It's trust without evidence. You need courage to commit to something, especially if you do it publicly, because it's harder to go back on. Make a public commitment. Have courage to commit to something to make the world better. You need courage to love. Think about that and what it takes, because you have to let something go, like your defense, your wall, the barbed wire that you keep around your heart. You need grit to stick to it. You need grit to keep going. You need grit to help you think sometimes. You need to grind up against something and other people sometimes, to shape your own thinking, to get educated, to believe, to once again invest in the courage too. And you need grace. You need forgiveness. You need kindness. You need respect. You need compassion. All of these are part of grace. You need to get it. You need to be looking out for it, because it's coming to you all the time. Look for where you find it, and you need to give it. And a part of making the change that people have talked about here is giving it. Not just telling other people to have compassion, but finding your compassion. So this is my story, and these are my reasons for telling this story. And I'm hoping that you will take all of the stories here and put them into a package that will help you move forward in resisting and in changing. Thank you.
That was our final story from activist and poet Kathleen Sadat. You can see videos of all of these stories and more on the Meteorites YouTube channel or at meteorites.org. Thank you for joining us for this Black Femme episode of the ISM Storytellers Project, a series of live events produced by Meteorites with support from the Portland City Art and Culture Access Fund and Ronnie S. LaCroute. The show theme is by Clark Salisbury. We featured music by composer Joe Kai. Here is music at joekai.org. This oral history audio program is made possible in part by the Oregon Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the America 250 Oregon Commission. This is a co-production of Meteorites and Oregon Arts Watch. Find these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org. This was a special edition of Stage and Studio. I'm DeMelo Roberts.